You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's been 7 days. There's 24 hours a day, so I don't know how many hours it is, but it's hundreds of hours since we last got to do this. And here we have an hour and a quarter to spend with Nagarjuna, so let's rejoice in that. We'll start by setting our motivation. I'm particularly just kind of amazed thinking about how old this text is. I'm thinking it must be 1800 years old, maybe 1600 years old, I don't know. And then another text we're going to look at a little bit tonight is at the time of the Buddha, so 2600 years old of the teachings, not the text, but the teachings. So just amazed that we have this opportunity to, you know, to spend time with these teachings and to use them due to all the kindness of just so many Buddhists over the millennia. And in particular tonight, I'm thinking about the Buddha's equanimous mind and how that's such a needed basis for us to develop our bodhicitta. And that in itself would be just a tremendous asset to just getting through the day and then being able to build all the different causes to become a Buddha, to benefit all beings. So let's take our time tonight to try to move ourselves forward along this path and really rejoice in the opportunity that we have. And may this little bit that we do tonight be another drop in the bucket, and may we become Buddhas, and may we be able to benefit many beings. So may we have many karmic connections with beings, so that we can be of benefit to them. So we're reviewing the quiz from Precious Garland, and we're in question 16, and I'm going to pretty much teach that one, and then the other ones we're going to maybe have a little more input, but I was quite interested in this question, maybe because I've read more about karma than I have about ascetic practices. But at any rate, the three verses, number 11, 12, and 13 from the root text, I think are really concerned with this question, which was, why didn't the Buddha have his disciples practice asceticism? So the three verses are, 11 is, Dharma does not come merely through engaging in physical austerities. Through that type of practice, one neither ceases harming others, nor does one benefit them. And then the next verse, one who does not respect the great path of the true Dharma with its manifest generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude, follows the mistaken path of inflicting hardship on the body, just as a cow in a herd follows the line of cattle in front. And 13. Such a person with a body entwined by the savage snakes of negative mental states wanders for a very long time in the terrifying wilderness of cyclic existence, whose trees are limitless beings. So I got interested in this topic, because my answer would have been right away, well, it just doesn't work. Asceticism and that, boom, we're done. Let's move on to the next question. So then, you know, I looked at some of the things that Venerable Chodron had taught about this, and first thing that kind of came to mind is that, well, what were the practices that they were doing? What were they doing? And Venerable Chodron mentioned to us that the non-Buddhists have many practices for trying to attain higher rebirth or liberation, and they're different from the 16 practices that we've been studying in this text for many weeks. And she mentioned things like fasting for long periods of time and bathing in the Ganges, sitting in fires, and remember this thing about jumping on top of a trident. If you landed on it right and it came out of your head, you were liberated. And some of them are walking around naked and being like dogs, or, you know, to burn out their dog karma, or standing on one foot. And so they thought these would purify them. All of these are things with the body, you know. And I used to think, oh, they just thought the body was the problem. But there are also people at the time of the Buddha who definitely were looking at the mind. That's clear, too. But when they talk about this, they usually kind of point that out. And I kind of ended the story there. So then I went to look at the long-length discourses of the Buddha, and I wanted to include that in this tonight. And so first there was in the one, the great lion's roar, there was actually a naked ascetic, a kasapa, who went to the Buddha and was asking him about these kind of practices. And this is these verses kind of tell us some of the practices. So I'll just read part of the verse. At this, Kasapa said to the Lord, the Buddha, Gotama, these ascetic practices of certain practitioners of self-mortification are considered proper to them. A naked ascetic uses no polite restraint, licks his hands, does not come or stand still when requested. He does not accept food offered or prepared for him, or an invitation to a meal. He does not accept food out of a pot or pan, nor the threshold among the firewood or the rice pounders, nor where two people are eating, from a pregnant or nursing woman, or from one living with a man, nor from gleanings, from where a dog is standing, from where flies are swarming. He eats no fish, no meat, drinks no rum, spirits, or fermented rice gruel. He is a one-house man, which means he would only visit one house for alms, or a one-piece man, meaning he'd only eat one meal, or a two-house man, a seven-piece man, or a seven-house man. He existed on one, two, or seven little servings, eating only once a day, once in 2 days, once in 7 days. He takes to eating rice twice a month. These are considered proper practices. Or a man becomes a herb eater, a millet eater, a rice, raw rice eater, a wild rice eater, an eater of water plants, of rusk husk powder, of rice scum, of the flowers of oil seeds, grass or cow dung, or forest roots and fruits, eating windfalls. He wears coarse hemp or mixed material, shrouds from corpses, rags from dust heap, garments of bark fiber, antelope skins, grass, bark, shavings, blankets of human hair or horse hair, the wings of owls. He is a plucker out of hair and beard, devoted to this practice. He is a covered thorn man, making his bed on them, sleeping alone in a garment of wet mud, living in the open air, accepting whatever seat is offered, living on filth and addicted to the practice. One who drinks no water, but they clarified that as very little water, and is addicted to the practice. Or he dwells intent on the practice of going to bathe 3 times before evening. So this is what the Buddha was seeing at his time. This, we had read before, previously in EMLs, a lot of the wrong views. But this is the practices. So as you can see, you know, these practices, none of them alone are going to be causes for liberation or higher rebirth from what we understand in the way we practice. And they don't necessarily forsake harming others, which is part of our ethical conduct, and nor do they necessarily help others. But this is what they were doing. And so it's interesting in this sutta that this person ends up kind of converting, you know, and how some of the suttas go, and then he becomes a follower of the Buddha. But in this sutta, he also, when he started off, he was kind of saying, well, what's the deal here? I've heard that you're saying that these practices don't help anyone. And actually what the Buddha replied was that, because he can see what happens to people, you know, from their previous actions, he said actually there were some who either had done a lot of self-mortification or just a little, who went to very poor realms in their next life, and others who didn't. So it wasn't, that alone wasn't kind of the determining factor. which I didn't know. That was interesting. So then the kind of the question is, well, then what are the faults that the Buddha saw in these practices, and how did he address this? And this is a very interesting sutta, just an excerpt. It's a little, maybe a little longer, but I think it really is helpful to my mind to, what I learned from this is exactly what Nagarjuna is saying would be exactly what the Buddha would say. And you'll see this as you hear what was happening, you know, what the ascetics were doing. So this is the great lion's roar to the Udambarikans. And so it's, we're picking up partway in it, and the main character, Nagroda, what the Buddha is talking to him, what was the subject of your conversation just now? What talk have I interrupted? This is another situation where these loud ascetics were noisy, 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 and they know the Buddha and his followers like silence, so when they see the Buddha, they just hush up. Maybe he'll come and talk to us if we're quiet. So it starts that way. And then the Nagroda replies, Lord, we saw the Blessed One walking up and down at the peacock's feeding ground by the Sumagata tank, which was an offered place for a lot of ascetics. And we thought, if the ascetic Gotama were to come here, we could ask him this question, Lord, what is the doctrine in which the Blessed Lord trains his disciples, in which those disciples whom he has so trained as to benefit from it recognizes their principal support in the perfection of the holy life? And now this next reply shows some of Buddha's skill. Nagroda, it is hard for you, holding different views, being of different inclinations and subject to different influences, following a different teacher, to understand the doctrine which I teach my disciples. Come on then, Nagroda, ask me about your own teaching, about your extreme austerity. How are the conditions of austerity and self-mortification fulfilled, and how are they not fulfilled? Mm-hmm. So he just knows he's not going to get anywhere except for by just going right to what they're doing. So then, at this, the wanderers made a great commotion and noise, exclaiming, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, how great are the powers of the ascetic Gotama in holding back his own theories and inviting others to discuss theirs. So they were, you think, a little open. Silencing them, Nagroda said, Lord, we teach the higher austerities, we regard them as essential, we adhere to them. Such being the case, now he's asking the Buddha, what constitutes their fulfillment or non-fulfillment? And so then the Buddha goes, suppose, Nagroda, a self-mortifier goes naked, and he goes through that whole list that I just read. And then he says, and then he ends with the practice of bathing 3 times before evening. What do you think, Nagroda, is the higher austerity thereby fulfilled or not? So he just lists everything it is. Do you think it's fulfilled? And the Nagroda says, indeed, Lord, it is fulfilled. And Buddha answers, but Nagroda, I maintain that this higher austerity can be faulted in various ways. And then he replies, in what way, Lord, do you maintain that it can be faulted? He might have wished he hadn't asked. Because now he's going through everything he's seen. And when you go back and read Nagarjuna's verses, you'll say, now I know what he's talking about. Take the case, Nagroda, of a self-mortifier who practices a certain austerity. As a result, he's pleased and satisfied at having attained his end. And this is a fault in that self-mortifier, because he's pleased and satisfied with himself. Or else, in doing it, he elevates himself and disparages others. This is a fault in that self-mortifier. Or else he becomes intoxicated with conceit, infatuated, and therefore careless. This is a fault in that self-mortifier. Again, a self-mortifier practices a certain austerity that brings him gains, honors, and fame, and as a result, he's pleased and satisfied at his end. So this time, instead of attaining his end, he's just getting gains from it and honors, and he's happy about that. So he elevates himself, and he gets conceit, infatuated, and careless. And so that's kind of that topic. And then he goes on to other ones. A self-mortifier practices certain austerity. He divides his food into 2 heaps. Now we have to think about ourselves here. I think we've done some of the others, but he's saying, this suits me, this doesn't suit me. And what does not suit him, he eagerly rejects. While what suits him, He eats up greedily, recklessly, and passionately, not seeing the peril, with no thought for the consequences. And this is a fault in that self-mortifier. Again, a self-mortifier praises a certain austerity for the sake of gains, honors, and fame, thinking, kings and their ministers will honor me, the Brahmins and the householders and the religious teachers. So he's now like wanting honor. And then he's talking more about disparaging. He gives examples, like seeing an ascetic or a Brahmin, he's saying, see how he lives in abundance, eating all sorts of things, whether propagated from roots, from stems, from joinings, from cuttings, or filthily. He chews them all up with that thunderbolt of a jaw of his. They call him an ascetic. So he's just, now he's got one ascetic trash and somebody else. Or he sees another ascetic or Brahmin made much by the families being honored and respected, and he thinks, they make so much of that rich liver. They honor him, they respect him, they worship him. Whereas I am a real ascetic, a self-mortifier, get no such treatment. So he's envious. So then he's now, besides saying that, he's giving examples, which are pretty funny. And then a self-mortifier sits in a prominent position, and this is a fault of that self-mortifier. Or he goes around ostentatiously, which means pretentiously, making a display that's kind of vulgar, among the families, as if to say, see, this is my way of renunciation, and that's a fault. Or he behaves in an underhand way, so he basically is a conscious liar. I'm going to go through all the details. So that one's kind of a liar. And then another one, the next one, and this is where it gets kind of more important, when the Tathagata, or a disciple of the Tathagata, the Buddha, presents the Dhamma in a way that should command his assent, he withholds the assent. So he's should be kind of responding to the Buddha, but he doesn't, and that's a fault. Or he's angry and bad-tempered, and that's a fault. Or he's mean, spiteful, envious, jealous, crafty, deceitful, obstinate, proud, with evil desires, under their sway, wrong views, given to extreme opinions. He's tainted with worldliness, holding on firmly, unwilling to give up. Sound familiar? And this is a fault of that self-mortifier. What do you think, Nigrodha? Are these things faults in the higher austerity or not? What does he answer? He says, certainly are, Lord. It could happen that a single self-mortifier was possessed with all of these faults, not to speak of just one or the other. So he's basically assenting that he sees these faults in the ascetics. So now the Buddha goes, well, take the case of a self-mortifier who practices certain austerity, and as a result he's not pleased, not satisfied, not doing all of those things. He goes through all of them, right? He's not. And then he says, he's without wrong views, not given to extreme opinions, not tainted with worldliness, doesn't hold on firmly and not willing to give up. In this way, he is purified. So he goes through all of that and shows how you could be purified by getting rid of all those things. And then he says, what do you think, Nigrodha? Is the higher austerity purified by these things or not? And he answers, certainly it is, Lord. It attains its peak there, penetrating to the pith. So he thinks that's the end all and be all. And then the Buddha says, no, Nigrodha, it has not attained its peak there, penetrating to the pith. It has only reached the outer bark. So then he's kind of like, well, Lord, how does austerity attain its peak, penetrating to the pith? And what he then gets into, the first thing he teaches is what he calls a fourfold, and a self-mortifier who observes the fourfold restraint, not harming a living being, not causing a being to be harmed, not approving of such harming. So not harming, not taking what is given, not causing it to be taken or approving it, so not stealing essentially. Does not tell a lie, cause a lie to be told, or approve of lying, so not lying. And then the fourth one, does not crave for sense pleasures, cause others to do so, or approve of such craving, da-da-da-da-da. So basically, then he goes on from there and explains mindfulness, the five hindrances, and liberation. And what's interesting about this, when we come back to this, is he says, and you can reach liberation this way in 7 years. And then he brings it down to like 1 year, and then 7 months, and 1 month, and he gets down to like 7 days. And then I'll leave that because we're going to come back to that, because it's interesting how this sutta ends. So You can see from, you know, our first verse that we're looking at, the verses from Nagarjuna, that through that type of practice, one neither ceases harming others, nor does one benefit them. True. No. And from merely doing the physical austerities and everything that comes with them. Because then the next verse really says that, number 12, one who does not respect the great path of the true Dharma with its manifest generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude, follows a mistaken path of inflicting hardship on the body, just as a cow in a herd follows the line of cattle in front. And so basically, people who go on the wrong path, they're not really holding on to what is really the Dharma, which is, and here he's saying it, you know, this fourfold restraint. Nagarjuna, in the text, more talks about generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. And then, of course, you know, we had the 16 practices, but kind of summing them up a little bit. So they mistakenly think that if they endure pain or if they have excellent, good concentration, they're going to reach liberation. And that's not the case. Because when they reach the time of death, that's not really going to help them. And so then they could actually, at that time, just cling on to things and fall into hellish rebirths. So, and what's worse than that is not only do they practice them, but they lead others astray, which is why we have the part in here about the cows, because one cow follows another and they go into the thicket. And so you actually ruin others by that and cause others to suffer as well. And then how the sutta then ends, I thought was interesting. Because a lot of times in these suttas, the person converts and there is a, you know, happy ending, you know. This one was like totally different. So I'm just giving you the shortest part of it to make this go faster, but it goes like this. There are, Nagarjuna, unwholesome things that have not been abandoned, tainted, conducive to rebirth, fearful, productive of painful results in the future, associated with birth, decay, and death. It is for the abandonment of these things that I teach the Dharma. If you practice accordingly, these tainted things will be abandoned, and the things that make for purification will develop and grow. And if you all attain to and dwell in this very life by your own insight and realization in the fullness of perfected wisdom. And at these words, the wanderers sat silent and upset. Their shoulders drooped. They hung their heads and sat there, cast down, bewildered. So possessed were their minds by Mara. They were like not one of them, and there were a whole big crowd of them. Then the Buddha said, every one of these foolish men is possessed by the evil one Mara, so that not a single one of them thinks, let us now follow the holy life proclaimed by the ascetic Gautama, that we may learn it. For what do 7 days matter? You know, like they can't even think about spending 7 days looking into it. Not one of them budged. So then the Lord, the Buddha, uttered his lion's roar at the Udambarika Park, rose in the air, and alighted on Vulture's Peak. Da-da-da-da. So he split. But the footnote says that some of these wanderers benefit later. So, but at the time, they just not one of them moved. Well, a little different. So you could see why verse 13 is the case. Such a person with a body entwined by the savage snakes of negative mental states wanders for a very long time in the terrifying wilderness of cyclic existence, whose trees are limitless beings. So, do you think we answered the question?
Yes.
Okay, so I have just a little more on that, because some of the things came to mind for me. Just one verse for our modern times, because we have talked about this before. What is our ascetic practice here? We've talked about this. And we took this from Lama Tsongkhapa, and we had these teachings when we were taught about essence of refined gold, because this is where Lama Tsongkhapa is quoted. And he said, patience is the supreme ornament of real heroes, a supreme self-mortification to overcome afflictions, the Garuda bird to destroy the snake of anger, armor to protect you from the arrows of criticism, Knowing this, in every way, familiarize yourself with the armor of patience supreme. Remember that? We talked about this. What is the ascetic practice we do now? Fortitude. And then, actually, also there are ascetic practices taught in Buddhism. And you can look these up, actually, in Wikipedia. They're straight out of the Path of Purification, which is the main commentary in the Pali Canon. But I just want to read the introduction from that. The 13 ascetic practices, I'm not going to go through them all, but they're easy to find. And what I found on the web seemed straight out of the text, so it seemed like good information. But in the text, the Path of Purification, which is, I think, Buddhaghosa, it's the main commentary that any Theravada Buddhist would be looking at. He opens this up, these ascetic practices, the Dutanga practices. He says, it's kind of like the motivation, because that's the main thing that's different here. Now, while the meditator is engaged in the pursuit of virtue, he should set about undertaking the ascetic practices in order to perfect those special qualities of fewness of wishes, contentment, etc., by which the virtue of the kind already described is cleansed. So he already has virtue and he wants to even cleanse that even more. For when his virtue is thus washed clean of stains by the waters of such special qualities as fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, seclusion, dispersion, energy, and modest needs, it will become pure, quite purified, and his vows will succeed as well. And so when his whole behavior has been purified by the special quality of blameless virtue and vows, he has become established in the first three of the ancient ones' heritages, ancient noble ones' heritages. He may become worthy, or I would say she, may become worthy to attain the fourth called delight in development. Therefore, we shall begin the explanation of the ascetic practices, and they explain these 13. Of which, actually, I think when I read about this a year or two ago, when we were changing rooms, actually, because that's kind of one of them, actually. Some people do one of these, some do more than one. You can do just one, and there's different, they have a lot of information about it. But there are some people that we know of who did a number of them, like Ajahn Mun, and also Ajahn Chah. So, and then we have the practices that we're familiar with, like our Nune practice, and we do fire offerings and things like that as Buddhists, which non-Buddhists also do, obviously, different kind of fasting practices and this and that. But ours are very different, both in many ways, the motivation, the practice, and the conclusion of them, they're completely different from these ones that we are reading about tonight. So, okay, that was 16. Now 17 is, these 16 practices are summarized into three. What are they, and how are the 16 summarized in them? So does anyone have the summary of the 16?
Generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude.
Right, generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude, which is essentially what we talked about just earlier in that other question. And so generosity, people might have this differently. I took most of these out of the teachings, and then I think I threw in a few of my own thoughts. But from the teachings, under generosity, because there's 16 things that we're trying to put in those three categories, right? I had respectful generosity, also to honoring the worthy, because it says in our text that respectful generosity is making offerings to those who are worthy of a respectful attitude and in a respectful manner. So that ties those two together in my mind. And then there were four kinds of generosity described, and one of them was love, so that was one of the 16. And those are the three that I put under generosity. Did anyone have any other ones? I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to look at these. It's quite generous not to kill somebody, too. You know?
Yeah.
But There's a lot of ways.
There's a better fit.
But there's a better fit for that one. Anyone have any other ones? No? Okay. Then ethical conduct, which we know you abandon the 10 non-virtues, so we have those 10 for sure, which is killing, stealing, adultery, lying. I'm using the words as they were in the text, in the root text, which is, by the way, these are verses 8, 9, and 10, primarily. 8, 9, and 10. So killing, refraining from killing, stealing, adultery, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle talk, covetousness, malice, nihilistic views is what they called it, wrong views. But also intoxicants, wrong livelihood, and harm. And then we had fortitude. And that one, it was spoken of as having three kinds: the fortitude of not retaliating, of enduring hardship and suffering, and of practicing the Dharma. But in my mind, I didn't go back to listen to all the audio, but so I took this from my own thoughts. For me, fortitude, all 16 fit into it in one way, shape, or form, I thought. Because it takes some fortitude to abandon all of these non-virtues, and it sometimes takes some fortitude to be generous. Because we actually, you know, when we learn about the six perfections, they're all related to, we have the fortitude of generosity, right? The fortitude of, so I thought it might take a little fortitude to honor the worthy, could potentially, I don't know, maybe that one would be easier. Cultivating love, definitely, because they're like mirror images of each other. And I also thought there were a lot of cross relationships with like intoxicants, because, well, I don't know, I just thought that fortitude, there's kind of a clarity of mind that they talk about in fortitude, and that's like, you need that maybe even to get off of intoxicants. You know, it's not easy for people who are trying to get rid of habits. I think it takes some fortitude, actually, to kick habits. That's my own two cents. And wrong livelihood, it also could. I don't know. Anyone have any thoughts about that one?
That's the most interesting thought, I think. I mean, yours is more interesting.
Oh, that I include all of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, to me, I think it kind of does. Because you have to, okay, if you think of it, not retaliating, enduring hardship and suffering. Well, there's suffering involved with people who are trying to give up intoxicants. There's suffering involved when you're trying to get out of wrong livelihood even. Yeah. I mean, people have to make huge changes in their life sometimes. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, there's things to, I don't know, when I think of fortitude, that part of like how you have a clarity of mind to act or not act, when I think of it in that way, then I think, yeah, that would work in all of these. Okay, now we're on 18.
Just to recall that love entails all six perfections, which you've listed, but we didn't say that explicitly.
Say more.
Because that's what I was covering last week when Venerable was teaching about the...
love entails all six perfections.
Yeah.
But say more.
Oh, sorry. So it was the four immeasurables, not all six perfections. Yeah. All four immeasurables. Oh. So in that light, seems like fortitude could be a part of all of that.
Could you restate that? I'm a little mixed up of what you're saying. Then.
So of the three to practice.
Of the three to practice.
Honoring the honorable, mm-hmm. respectful,
oh,
caring,
yeah.
and love.
Right.
That love is all four, involves all four measures.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So
okay.
Love, compassion, sympathetic
right.
joy, equanimity. Mm-hmm. So trying to match up the fortitude to those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both refraining from harm, but, mm-hmm. but somehow, I don't know, somehow.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so number 18. Why do people who have wrong views about karma and its effects fall to the unfortunate realms? Okay, I thought this related to verses 18 through 21, but especially 20 and 21. people have things they want to say right off the bat? Let me read these verses. It'll prompt your memories. 18. From anger comes a bad complexion and stupidity. Since one will not... Let's see. From anger comes a bad complexion. I wonder if I copied that right. That doesn't sound right. And stupidity. That's something
stupidity.
There's something wrong there.
Yeah, it's the next line.
And stupidity, since one will not question the wise. Oh, there we go. We're just reading it wrong. Can't read. These are the effects when one is reborn as a human, but prior to all of them is a bad rebirth. Such are widely known to be the fruitional results of these actions, which I add the word actions. They are called the non-virtues. For all of the virtuous actions, there are opposite effects. And here we get to the ones that are even closer. Verse 20 and 21. Attachment, anger, and confusion, and the karma that arises from them are non-virtuous. Non-attachment, non-anger, non-confusion, and the karmas that arise from them are virtuous. From non-virtue comes all suffering, likewise all negative rebirth. From virtue comes all positive rebirths and the happiness within all births. So I start this off just like this. The question is, people who have wrong views about karma and its effects, why do they fall to bad rebirths? I start it with this. They're confused. That's how it goes for me. And this confusion or ignorance, we know, has two forms. There's one about the ignorance of the nature of reality, and there's one about ignorance about karma and its effects. So, as a little side trip here, we got into this topic about the ignorance of the ultimate nature isn't naturally negative, it's neutral. But it motivates both non-virtuous and virtuous actions or karma of ordinary beings. But the ignorance of karma and its effects is naturally negative because it's confused regarding virtue and non-virtue. You know, and that confusion is present whenever we create non-virtuous karma or non-virtuous actions. So the propelling karma is the karma that propels us into the next life. And all propelling karma, whether it's virtuous or non-virtuous, is created under the influence of self-grasping ignorance. And so it's polluted in that way. But the virtuous karma isn't affected by this ignorance of karma and its effects. So, for example, when you make prostrations, you may have self-grasping ignorance present, but your prostration could be neutral, and the faith you might have could actually be virtuous. But you still have this, like, pollution of self-grasping ignorance there. And so that's a polluted virtuous karma, and it will lead to an upper rebirth, right? Whereas the non-virtuous propelling karma is motivated by both kinds of ignorance, the ignorance of the ultimate nature and the ignorance of karma and its effects. So to give a couple of examples of this non-virtuous propelling karma, say someone has some kind of false, say someone feels quite entitled, they lie and cheat, this and that, and they think it's okay to do that. Or maybe the example we usually hear about is like animal sacrifice. There's ignorance. They think that it will please God, and they actually think it's good for the animal. You know, they're liberated or something. So in both of these situations, the motivation has both kinds of ignorance there. The self-grasping ignorance, and it's ignorance of karma and its effects, because they're confused. And so it's polluted, non-virtuous karma. And so in this verse that we just read, this is what they're talking about. It's the ignorance regarding karma and its effects. So that particular ignorance, along with attachment and anger, is the three poisons. That's the kind of ignorance we're talking about when we say the three poisons. And they are negative by nature, and so are the actions that you produce under their influence. Because that's how it is. That's how we understand karma. So it's kind of strange, really, to think, though, that a karma that you can create with confusion isn't necessarily a destructive one. Why? Because you have the confusion of the nature of reality. So, I don't know if that helps your conversation. So, the conclusion in some sense is that destructive or non-virtuous karma, these actions that they were confused about, these are actions of the body, speech, and mind, and they're created under these three poisons of attachment, anger, confusion. And these are non-virtuous. And from all non-virtue, as verse 21 says, comes all suffering, likewise all negative rebirth. So basically, the ripening result of non-virtuous karma is going to be a lower rebirth in a lower realm. So it's kind of interesting to note in this that the cause for a rebirth is virtuous or non-virtuous. The cause of that rebirth is negative karma, right? But the rebirth itself, the body and mind that you take, the aggregates that you take that are the ripening result, they're not virtuous or non-virtuous. They're neutral. We don't really think of it usually that way. We usually think but they might be suffering, but they aren't. That in itself is a neutral result. And another thing, the other verse that affects this, that relates to karma and rebirth, is verse 18. And that is that from anger comes a bad complexion and stupidity, since one will not question the wise. These are the effects when one is reborn as a human. But prior to them, all is a bad rebirth. So what that's saying is that the ripening result first was the bad rebirth, and then that karma is continuing to affect the person in another life as a human. That's when they're talking about humans in that verse. So this is ripening results of actions are experienced first. We're talking about complete karma, complete actions. And then after that are the ones that we call causally concordant and environmental results. And we get to that in the next question. But so basically in this question that we're talking about, where you're reborn, well, the first kind of result is, if it's complete karma, can be the rebirth. Does that make sense? I'm not sure if I'm saying that very well. So here's the text that talks about this. There's kind of two versions, but I'm just going to give the one. It says that Yogacara Bhumi, destructive actions done with a very strong motivation bring the ripening result of rebirth in a hell realm. Middling intensity motivation as a hungry ghost and weak motivation, rebirth as an animal. And it's interesting that they point to the motivation, because later in the next question that they relate each part of the karma to which kind of result you get. Those get tied together. And it's the motivation that has the most to do, apparently, with the actual rebirth, fruitional, yeah, rebirth. That's the word I'm looking for. So, and then that's why verse 19 says, such, and what goes there is such lower realm rebirths are widely known to be the fruitional results of these actions that are called the non-virtues. So he's kind of emphasizing that point. Does that make sense? Did you follow all that? Too fast? What part didn't you get? Okay, you got that. You have the confusion of the karma, and it's naturally negative. So boom, you go to a lower realm. And did you get that ripening results are related, tend to come first with a complete action? See, when you have a complete action, you get all four results of karma can happen. And then what they're saying here is that the fruitional result that causes a rebirth tends to be the first. So that's why that verse says first they have a lower rebirth, and then these next things are experienced when they're a human. They've worked their way out of that, and now they still have that karma is still being worked out. It's not really done. The results aren't done. You're not done experiencing the results, and so then you get, you know, other results as a human. So that was another point, which I think is, I don't know, interesting. And then there's the thing, how the motivation makes a difference, which we've heard before. There's different thoughts about that, but this one is that if you have a really strong motivation, you go to the hell realms. If your motivation is more middling intensity, you go to the hungry ghost. And if it's mild motivation, you know, our motivations sometimes are very strong and sometimes they're weak. But they're still complete actions. If you have a complete action, you could have a strong motivation or a weak motivation, but you could still have a complete action, a complete karma. So maybe we need to go through that. I'll do that first thing in the next question. Okay, question 19. What are the three, expanded into four, results of karma? Make examples of each of them for the 13 actions to be abandoned, as well as for miserliness, jealousy, anger, and not questioning the wise. So this is where I put the listing the results of karma. So complete actions have, here it says, three results expanded into four. So one way you could say it is there's the ripening result, the causally concordant result, and the environmental result. You could say three. And the second one you can split into two, which is the causally cordant result in terms of our experience and the causally cordant result in terms of our behavior or, you know, habitual tendencies. But she said, well, the thing I had read, it was worded as behavior. So the ripening result, that's the rebirth that we're going to take. And in the last verse they were saying, but prior, in verse 18, these are the effects when one is reborn as a human, this bad complexion and stupidity because blah, 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 what you had done. But prior to all of them is a bad rebirth, saying that you're first getting this fruitional result first, that first result. And the other ones come later. This causally concordant result comes second, and the environmental result third. So the ripening result is the rebirth. The causally concordant result, the one that's results similar in terms of our experience, that's the kind of experiences that we have in this life, which are going to be similar to what we cause other people to experience. You know, kind of like what goes around comes around, right? And then there's results similar to the cause in terms of our behavior, and that's the tendency to do things again. You know, we're creatures of habit. We have a tendency to, you know, didn't we do this when we lost our power? How many times did we flip on light switches even though there was no power? You know, we're creatures of habit. We walk into a room and we flip switches even when there's no power. You know, I did anyway. And then the environmental result, has qualities. That's the qualities of the place that we live. And it's funny that Venerable mentioned this thing. Sometimes people have the possibility to leave a place, an unpleasant place, and live someplace else, but they insist they have to stay there. And she said that was their environmental result. Mm-hmm. It's funny to me. That kind of fits with, sometimes when I talk with Venerable Jindy, she thinks about karma a lot, I think. And I realize sometimes, for myself, I think, you know, when I'm really hitting my head against a wall and I can't get anywhere even though I'm trying, I just have to kind of at one point say to myself, well, you haven't created the causes, but also this is a result of, you know, you just karmically aren't ready or something, you know, that's my words for it, but you know, this is their environmental result. They just can't see how to get out of this place, even though they could just probably pick up and move. She didn't say much more about that, but I thought it was interesting. Okay, so when the branches, when you do an action, when they're complete, those branches are if you say it as three, there's a motivation, there's the actual action, and there's the conclusion. That's one way to say it. If those are complete, then each of these complete actions has the potential to bring all of those three or four results over the span of several lifetimes. So So you could say, for example, that's what the question is kind of asking you, well, what are these results that you're going to get from all of these things, right? Well, say for killing, the ripening result would be rebirth in a lower realm. And then the later, when you're reborn as a human, you would experience a short life. That would be the causally concordant result in terms of experience, a short life. And then the one causally concordant result in terms of behavior would be the tendency, would like killing, you know, and that would then create more destructive karma. So of those three, and then there's environmental result. Of those, that third one, though, that I mentioned, this causally concordant result in terms of behavior, it's a mouthful. We just like to say the habit. The habit, it's easier. That's actually the one that's the worst of all of those four results. It's not what we usually think. We usually think, the lower realms. But actually, the habit is worse. Because there's an end point to being in a lower realm. But when you have a habit of doing something, you haven't really established an end point. You're creating like destructive karma that's going to lead you again and again and again to lower rebirths. So if you have a bigger perspective, you can actually see how the habit, you know, is worse. And why? Because we're creating more and more and more and more and more causes to experience all these kind of sufferings and all the other results. And why do the three, here's where it gets into the different parts, why do you get three results from one action? And this is because of the parts. The motivation principally brings the ripening result. The actual action principally brings these causally concordant results. And the conclusion of the action principally brings the environmental result. And you have to know that it would only be the Buddha who could figure all that out, because we can't see that. That's too hidden. So a lot of these things, you know, this is what the Buddha taught. So on the question, you know, like, what are these four results from each of these things? Well, let's say first, we've talked about what a complete action is. We've talked about ripening results. Actually, all of these actions, the answer is the same. Mm-hmm. All of them can lead you to the lower realms. So boom, you've finished that whole column. And then the causally concordant result in terms of our behavior, the tendency to do the action, that's the same for all of them. Whatever you're doing, you're creating a tendency to do it again, whether it's virtuous or non-virtuous, right? And you have all this familiarity with these behaviors, and you just continue them. So the ones that we're really going to cover then here are the other two, which are, what are the causally concordant results in terms of our experience, and what are the environmental results? And so all of these, first many of them, are covered exactly in the verses for the result in terms of our experience. So for killing, due to killing, here's the root text says, due to killing, one is born with a short lifespan. So we have a short life. And the environmental result manifests in our living in a certain place. And for this one, it's living in a place filled with conflicts and war. And this is stuff I would make sure you write down so you have this, because this is the part to meditate on. The other ones you can remember. Lower realm for the first one, and habit to do the same thing for the other. But these, you know, we want to kind of, it's good to memorize, because they can actually stop you from doing things. There's a purpose to this. Okay, so the environmental result of killing was a place with conflicts and war. Additionally, food, drink, and medicine there won't be potent. And if you want, I can send you this. If you don't want to write all this, I'm happy to email this to people. I put it in a chart. I put it in Excel, actually, and also Word. Sometimes it works better if you use Excel. Okay, stealing. Due to stealing, one becomes impoverished. That doesn't. That makes complete sense. You know, they make sense. So stealing is taking things that haven't been freely given to us. So we end up being poor, having few possessions, difficulty accessing and using our possessions. So the place that you live in would have many dangers, poverty, floods, droughts. It's difficult to keep your possessions safe due to natural causes or thieves. You can kind of see, when you have floods, you lose stuff. You don't lose your life, too. You know, droughts, you lose stuff, too. Okay, and then next one is sexual misconduct. And the root verse is, due to adultery, one has enemies. So relationship problems, spousal problems. Your spouse becomes like an enemy. I think that's what Venerable Children said. Or your spouse might run off with somebody. Or a disagreeable spouse, she said once. And then the environmental result, living in a dirty place with poor sanitation and lots of misery. I think that makes sense, actually. It's my 2 cents. That adds up in my mind. Lying, the root verse is, by lying one becomes reviled. So you'd face a lot of criticism and blame. Even though you haven't done anything to cause it in this life, it's like coming back like a boomerang from lying in a past life. So you'd be criticized, slandered, deceived. People don't believe you. That would be enough to want you to stop right there. I don't like criticism. Maybe I should quit lying. I actually work on lying. Lying isn't big for me. Even my whole life, lying is not big lying. Little lying I've had to learn about. So now I get tried not to do any of it. Actually, I think we were talking about this the other day. When you have the tendency to want to conceal something, right there, you need to stop. And just, that's one of the biggest things in our community, and one of the biggest things I've learned from Venerable Children is this thing about transparency. And that's just the beginning of a slippery slope, and you don't want to go there. What you're going to get is worse than anything you would experience from just, you know, acknowledge, owning up, own it. Okay. So the environmental result of lying, living in a place with a foul odor, surrounded by untrustworthy people, fear and corruption in society is rampant. A lot of fear. Yeah. That sounds kind of familiar. Mm-hmm. No wonder they have so much trouble in Congress. The things they say to get into office sometimes are just, you know, it's just everyone accepts in our country that what they say isn't true. And then you wonder why they have problems once they get in. Okay, and then divisive speech, the root text is, through speaking divisively, one loses friends. So you could have even long-time harmonious relationships that crumble. Separated from good friends. And then the environmental result is living in a place where it's bumpy and uneven, so travel is difficult. How does that make sense? Kind of like it divides. The rocks divide you from each other or something. Hard to get together because you can't get in. Yeah, you know, when I went to India on pilgrimage, we took a ride one day that in our country would take, I don't know, under 2 hours. It took us 16 hours. It was just bump, 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 bump the whole time. It was quite travel, difficult travel. It's amazing. Harsh speech. The root verse is, due to speaking harshly, one hears unpleasant sounds. So you hear ridicule, scorn, getting insulted, abused, put down, criticized. So, you know, the thing to do with that is just, it really does help the mind to say, wow, I created the cause for this. This is what I say to myself sometimes. I create my own experience. No one else is creating my experience. I am creating my own experience. No one else is creating this experience. No one. I create my own experience. So anything I'm hearing, whether it's meant or not meant, whether I'm deluded or hearing it with great clarity, I've created this experience. And when your environmental result, you would be a barren and dry place inhabited by uncooperative people, a place with thorns and sharp stones. Harsh speech is like that. Sharp, like getting pricked. Okay, then we have idle talk. I don't have environmental results for all of these. Maybe you do, but I run out after wrong views, I think. I don't know where to find them. Idle talk. From engaging in idle talk, one's words will be disregarded. Yeah, of course. Yeah. People can't listen that long. We don't have that great of listening skills. It's really hard to concentrate that long, sorry. And around here, I'm too tired. I'm not awake enough to listen that long, so you better not talk too long. Okay, sometimes people think we're lying, although what we say is true. That's a bummer. Or we want to, you know, we express something honestly or contribute a good idea, but other people disregard it. They don't respect what we're saying. They don't value or listen to our words. So, yeah, that doesn't feel good. So we created the cause. So better give that up too. So the environmental result is living in a drab place with unbalanced climate. So the fruit doesn't ripen at the proper time. Things dry up. A drab place, unbalanced climate. What do you think? How do you put that together?
Boring.
Boring. Well, there is that. Things dry up.
Drab.
Yeah, fruit doesn't ripen. Yeah, it could be a juicy fruit that you would enjoy, but it's kind of like, I don't have enough energy for this. Okay, covetousness. Even if I try sometimes, I can't make myself do it. I had a job once where I worked with a doctor who could not stop talking. And I actually had to learn to just walk out of the room. I worked there for 2.5 years. He was a very wonderful person, but he really couldn't stop talking. And I literally, it was the hardest thing. I just had to just walk out of the room. It's weird. Covetousness. Covetousness destroys one's desired objects, is the root verse. So we can't obtain what we desire. We have a hindrance to accomplishing our plans and our goals. We might also have a lot of intense desire and craving. That all makes sense. I think the environmental result makes sense too. Small crops and the environment constantly deteriorates. You never can quite get what you want. Everything is just, it's like a hungry ghost. And then malicious intent, the root verses, malice is said to bestow fear. So you might become easily frightened or suspicious of others. This is a result of malice towards others. And one time, Venerable thought in her mind that paranoia, fear, suspicion, and lack of trust were related to this. And in terms of where we live, it would be a place with epidemics, disputes, dangerous animals, poisonous snakes, a dangerous place. And that just completely makes sense. Malicious intent, fear, the wrong views. Wrong views lead to evil worldviews. I would like to say destructive worldviews. That work? I don't usually I don't go much for the word evil. Our root text has that. So with this, it's hard to think about the correct view. You can't think very clearly. Also, you're drawn into, you have more of a tendency to be drawn into wrong views because you've held them previously. You might have a lot of deceitful thoughts in this life from holding wrong views in past lives. Also, Venerable has mentioned before, being born deeply ignorant, possibly some mental disabilities would be from that. Or you might be intelligent but ignorant in terms of the Dharma, because a lot of people are very intelligent but they don't grok this at all. And then the environmental result is a place with few crops, you lack a home and you lack a protector. How do you see that one? I get the protector. A home. Well, there's really...
There's no refuge.
Yeah, there's no refuge. There you go. Yeah. Okay, intoxicants. The root verse says, consuming intoxicants brings mental confusion. So you get this both in this life, a lack of mental confusion, a lack of clarity in this life and in future lives. Does anyone have any environmental results? I don't know where to even find those for these. I've never seen them. So we're just...
But you can even imagine being in being born into an environment where their intoxicant use is the norm.
Right.
I think would be very reasonable.
And things don't make sense. Wrong livelihood. The root verse is wrong livelihood results in getting tricked. So people deceive and trick us. You might have people wanting to invest in things that are shams, or people might want to borrow your money and no intention of paying it back. Harm. Due to violence, one encounters much torment. That's the root verse. That's pretty general. I think that works because harm is so ubiquitous. So we're inflicting violence on others, so we're going to receive the same. Being beat up or maimed by others or experiencing great physical pain, even though we haven't physically harmed others in this life, that's the result of inflicting violence on others in past lives. This is really something to purify because it's so easy to cause harm. And we even do it like without maliciousness, just sometimes out of ignorance. You know, I mean, most of us grew up crunching insects left and right. You know. And the woman who did it?
The perpetrator is 40 years old. She was having a successful life. People described her as pleasant and intelligent. And out of the blue,
You know, I heard a story once that it was some kind of workshop people were doing. And it was very similar to that. These two people, actually I think it was two women, they didn't know each other. And it was one of these kind of things where you talk to each other and encounter, an encounter group of some sort. I don't know what era this was from, but I just remember the long and short of it was they didn't know each other, but I think the woman who told me this said, I think I must have had some really horrible negative karma with this person because they almost got into a brawl. I think they actually got into like a wrestling match or something. It was like, somebody you don't even know, take them down. it was physical. It was physical. And they didn't even know each other. It's exactly like that, only not so. Yeah, that's. And it's probably it was a sane person, even, you know, not somebody who had some psychic break, even, you know, just. Yeah. That's very sad. Really. We're on miserliness now. And the root verse is, through not giving gifts, one is poor. So stinginess, miserliness, is going to lead to being poor in future lives, and even in this life. So any poverty we have now is from not being generous in the past. It's exactly the opposite of what we think. You know, like, if I give this, I'm not going to have anything. That's how the mind goes. Jealousy. The root verse says, jealousy brings about unattractive appearance. Anybody remember that? Thought about it. So when our body is feeble, lacks vitality, has unpleasant appearance, this is a result of being jealous of others' wealth and possessions in previous lives. You've kind of like sucked it out. You're lacking vitality. Actually, jealousy is so awful. It's really, it's good to live here. You get to learn about it. Really, I didn't know I even had jealousy before I moved here. Pride and jealousy were—they're very. If we get in the book that you're reading every morning, what's that called? Words of My Perfect Teacher. I had to look up jealousy and pride in a number of books just to define it to myself to understand what it was in my experience. And some of the best things I got out of that book, and talking with Zopa, who had worked on pride, and it was very helpful. And once you get in touch with it, you don't want it in your life. I find it a little easier to get rid of. I mean, I didn't know I was plagued by it before. I remember going to therapy at one point in my life, and the therapist couldn't help me either. I was having some problems with my boss, and sometimes I'd be like a brother with him, and other times I just like couldn't stand, like, wow, you know. And he's a very good person, a person I like and care for, but my mind would just go bonkers. And so I thought, well, maybe I should try to figure this out. I couldn't figure it out in therapy. I figured out when I moved here years later.
Jealous.
I was jealous of things that, and I didn't know what that was. I didn't know, you know, it was like under subterfuge inside of me.
Why is it troubling so much? Because there's so many emotions involved. It's not just jealousy.
Yes.
It's everything.
Yeah, really. It really does. Yeah. It has anger. It has attachment. That's why, you know, with jealousy, when they say the antidote is rejoice in others' good qualities and be generous. No, not for me. Not right away. Not till I worked with it. Now I can do that. But first off, I had to use those verses from Nagarjuna that we got from the Chinese tradition. And it helped my mind to get more neutral. And it was something about being respectfully mindful of the other when giving, because these are all verses about generosity. And where that really helped me is I would look at the person. Because I realized actually a lot of times when I have afflictions in my mind, it really helps me to look at the person, because actually my mind is like in a story realm. And if I look at the person, I can't hold the story, you know? And in that one in particular, I was like, why am I jealous? This is a person who just wants this moment of happiness. You know, I mean, like, what's there to be jealous of here? Really, I really learned a lot here about that, and I'm really grateful of that. Because it actually, you know, they talk about with jealousy, you can't sleep. True. It really gets under your skin. Okay, well, if you haven't experienced that yet, have fun. Join the rock tumbler. It's coming. If it hasn't come yet, it will. Okay, we're on to anger. From anger comes a bad complexion. Okay, who had acne when they were kids? Bingo. No surprise. Unattractive appearance or bad complexion is a result of anger in past lives. Not questioning the wise. The root versus stupidity from not questioning the wise. So you might have followed unqualified teachers or people who weren't really qualified. So that would lead to being less, having less intelligence. Or we maybe, here she says, perhaps we had the opportunity to learn the Dharma, but we weren't interested, got distracted, or didn't respect those with good qualities. As a result, in this life, when we meet spiritual, we won't meet spiritual mentors properly explaining to us what to practice, what to abandon. so we would remain confused and ignorant. So it's really, encouraged in our tradition to ask questions. Wisdom comes from asking questions. But it is good to think about your questions before you ask them and get them worded. And you learn a lot from just trying to clarify yourself what your question is. A lot of times you answer it, but you learn a lot.
It's also including attending teachings, meditating upon the teachings.
Yep. Yep, attending teachings, meditating on the teachings. And then, you know, what wasn't in here but I found in the root verses was arrogance. It wasn't on our list for tonight, but in the root verses, in these same verses, there was one, arrogance leads to a lowly station. So being born in a low social position or group that faces prejudice is a result of being arrogant in past lives. So that's in the root verses. I don't know. You can just put these on your puja table. It's good.
Determined.
It's motivating to understand this. And these are things that, you know, we can't see. They make sense, actually. A lot of them make sense. But the details of karma, of course, are these extremely hidden phenomena, so we have to kind of rely on some of that. Does anyone have any comments or?
A question.
Yeah.
Regarding the important results of killing, which is a shortened lifespan by any humans who kill, or also includes other realms. And if you are human and kill, you only experience the shortened lifespan when you're born human again, or could it include being born as short?
Yeah, those are good questions. The what I read didn't clarify that. It was interesting. It was the verse was written for a human, I think, is why it said that. I don't think it would necessarily. My own opinion. I didn't find an answer to that, but I thought about it. My answer would be that the verse was written talking about humans, and then it went into something that was a broader situation, and so that's. It was explained that way because of how the verse was written. But I actually, my personal opinion would be, you'd have to ask the Buddha, but I don't think it would matter what realm you were in. I think that, I don't know why it would matter which realm you were in to have a short life. It seems like when you meet little kitties like your sister, brother-in-law saved, that cat could easily have died. And it was just so young. And to me, that's like that would be a result, a shortened life of an animal. We see that all the time. So I don't think that's my own thought, but I don't know the answer for sure. Yeah.
You say the most important is the motivation of the results of all action will be, and
the fruitional result.
Yeah. And so, you know, this thing of how important motivation is, you, 2 days ago or 3 days ago, you said something, Dakshin Rinpoche said to you repeatedly, could you repeat that?
Okay.
Everybody,
I have two of my teachers live in Seattle, and one of them, they're both Tibetan, and one's English isn't that great, so all of his time I've known him, the teachings have been short. Usually, I really think 3 sentences is about it. So I usually remember those. And I have to say, in all the time I've known him, there's never been a time where he didn't mention every teaching he gave publicly, every teaching he gave privately, which would be, not, well, maybe if it was 3 sentences, but even when he wrote me a letter, I found it in one of my books, a letter, I had sent something to him and he wrote back. And by the way, everything depends on your motivation. He said that. Every time. He never doesn't say that. Even when I saw him recently, I went to visit, motivation was definitely in there. In fact, actually, that was one of the things that he helped me with. He made me realize that maybe you're not really cultivating bodhicitta motivation to do this practice, and it would help if you thought about that. Maybe you're having trouble with this practice because you're not thinking about your motivation of a bodhicitta. And we didn't talk that long. Who was with me then? Somebody was. You were with me. How long? You said we were there like 15 minutes, maybe? that's pretty long for him and I to talk. I couldn't think of much else to say after that. But and I was also spoke with his son during that time, you know. So, yeah. And I thought, yeah, I think he's right. Wouldn't hurt. Yeah. And that thing also with karma, motivation is the most important aspect of it, you know. It's not, actions themselves aren't determined fully just by the action. Your motivation is a huge part of it, you know, the branches of a complete action. When they break it out bigger than we did tonight, you know, it has the things like the affliction that's present and all that, how you do the action, but motivation is number one. Yeah?
I was reading something recently that said even when we're not conscious of our motivation, when we act, we have a motivation.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, you have to have at least intention that's there.
Intention.
Yeah. We're often on automatic.
But even then we have some motivation.
Yeah, we do. That's what's great about doing retreat, is everything slows down and you have more clarity in the mind. You can see this more easily. No matter how your retreat's going, I would say, I don't know, don't you think everyone experiences this? I don't know. Those of you who have done retreat here, don't you find that naturally you have more clarity in your mind during retreat and you're more aware of these things? Anyone say yes to that? Okay. More than half of the group.
Also, during the course that Dharma taught, you know, Buddhism, one teaching many traditions, we're looking at craving.
Yeah.
We all shockingly discovered that we're all driven
by craving.
For some, by craving.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's yeah. By ignorance, but it's really alarming.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, I remember one retreat where I became aware of that and I hadn't before. I was like, oh my God, this is everywhere. No wonder the Pali tradition emphasizes that so much.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Because that's one place in the 12 links where you can cut things, you know.
Yeah, right.
Well,
I mean, I know that, but
not easier said than done.
Easier said than done.
Did you have something?
Yeah. Are there any more details about the fruitional results? Because we always talk about causally concordant results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is more. I think in the books that you're reading, those are the Geshe Sopa writes more on karma than anyone I've ever read. I mean, I don't know where you can. I don't know, but you like this book by Geshe Tashi Sering.
Well, I like Geshe Sering's book, but I also like Geshe Sonamichin's book on how karma works.
Mm.
But I don't know that he talks so much about the correlations of actions and the results.
Yeah. You know who else might... another book to look in is Geshe Nawang Darge.
Oh, phew.
Find his books. I'd be surprised if there wasn't stuff in there.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem to make sense because the causally concordant results are obvious, right?
Uh-huh.
You know that action brings this result.
Well, the reversional result is a lower rebirth.
Right, but there are more details about that.
In what sense?
Like killing what type of lower rebirth?
Oh, they answer that by in here about the motivation, the level of your motivation. If your motivation was... There were two versions. One of them was if your motivation was really strong, you'd go to a hell realm. The other, where they flip-flopped, was if your motivation was... Because so sometimes our motivations are very strong and clear, and other times they're not very strong and clear, but we do complete actions. His book is great on that, Geshe Sopa. But then, so the one that's the middle one, in general, they would say you go to the hungry ghost realms, but another text has it differently because they say that the beings in that realms are actually have more intelligence than animals. So it's, they flip-flop them. But they, and then if you had a more mild motivation, animal realm. Yeah. So they talk about it in that way. I'm sure there's a lot more in there. Yeah.
And they talk about the ways that you make your karma weightier. Or
yeah, lighter. The weight of karma. I can go through some of that with you because that leaves my a lot of it I know in my head, but I usually pull out my little, I have these little cards I used to put on my puja table. The weight of karma, which karma ripens first. The weight of karma is a really great thing to use. The weight. Yeah, the weight. And the reason is because you can use that to your advantage. I used to use that to set my motivation every day. I wanted to have a really strong motivation for my practice. So I would just pull out that thing of what makes a karma heavy. And I would try to do a heavy, virtuous karma when I set my motivation by fulfilling these parts. Okay, I think we better dedicate. It's getting late. Thank you for the questions. It's always fun to talk about these things. And so let's talk about these at lunch. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.